Good evening, and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, October 2nd, 2017. Juba residents pay out of their own pockets for police protection.
People say that let us contribute. Any house in the week will contribute £100. Any house. So we continue contributing up to now. Weekly, and they are calling police to come now in the Pequot here.
And IGAD leaders will talk to Riek Machar in their run-up to holding a forum on revitalizing the peace deal.
They are trying to bring everyone on board, because I have seen also people who were not part of the agreement, who revolved after the agreement, they are already being consulted, which I think is not a bad idea, because we need to stop this bloodshed in South Sudan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Residents of Juba's Kator neighborhood say they can now afford to sleep at night after they agreed to pay the police to provide security at night. Each family of Kator pays 100 South Sudanese pounds every week to the police, who in turn patrol the neighborhood to hunt armed criminals who have been terrorizing residents at night. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
Juba residents who have witnessed waves of nighttime armed robberies over the past months say they believe some of the robberies are carried out by police officers. Last week, when President Salva Kiir met with top police officers, he warned officers not to rob civilians. Kator neighborhood resident, who we will only identify as Bosco because of security reason, says his family was recently robbed at gunpoint by men believed to be security operatives.
People come in the night, so he come there, he's inside. They come and shoot the door with a big stone. And secondly, they shoot the gun. And my brother calling inside. They enter and take the money, 25,000.
Bosco says his neighbor's home has also been robbed several times. He says residents of Kator finally decided to do something about the nighttime robberies.
Even though we complain to the police, complain to the government, nothing will happen. So better let us do something to help the police, because the police now going to all the people who's working in the government, up to now going to 6 months without salary. So people say that let us contribute. Any house in the week will contribute £100. Any house. So we continue contributing up to now, weekly. And they are calling police to come now in the Pequot here.
Brigadier Daniel Justin, the South Sudan Police Service spokesman, admits residents were fed up with armed robberies and realized police had not been paid in months.
Some went as far as getting some money, so that they provide small things for the police and even those members of the community which work with the police. This is actually a very good initiative from them. For us, of course, by law, we are supposed to provide everything for our force, and we did, actually, especially providing food and fuel for the night patrol.
Justin says the security situation in the Kator has improved since residents started making their weekly contribution to police on night patrols. Residents of Kator started the payment about a month ago. Bosco worries that due to the economic crisis, residents might not be able to continue paying for police protection.
All the people are suffering. So even this 100, if it is weekly, sometimes to get this money, it is difficult. Because now no security. Even though somebody give you the place there to dig. But when you are in the place of a garden there, somebody will come and kill you.
Another Kator resident who only identified herself as Diana says her father pays the police on her behalf. Speaking in Arabic, she says since residents began paying the police, security has improved at night.
Before the community member began to pay the police, for the protection. Things were very bad. The robbers could come to our neighbor and others could stand at our door. When some neighbor who had a gun shoot up, they could say he is just scaring us, but we must get our right from Kator. But this day, things have got better.
Juba residents have often complained that in the past, police would often either ignore their calls for help during an emergency or they would arrive hours late. During his meeting with police officials last week, President Kiir blamed some Juba police officers and other security forces for participating in nighttime robberies. He also instructed the police to cooperate with the UN-backed regional protection forces. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
The Intergovernmental Authority on Development released a schedule for a forum to revive South Sudan's shaky 2015 peace deal. IGAD says it will send top officials to talk to rebel leader Riek Machar, President Salva Kiir, civil society groups, and new rebel groups like the National Salvation Front before holding this month's forum on the way forward. Waki Simon Mudu has more for VOA from Juba.
Benny Gideon of the South Sudan Law Society welcomes IGAD's initiative to revive the collapsed South Sudan's peace deal signed in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, in 2015. Gideon says the forum is another opportunity to end the nearly four-year-long conflict.
So to me, this is a good beginning for collective effort to arrive at finding the lasting solution to end violence in South Sudan.
According to the IGAD schedule released over the weekend, Ethiopian Foreign Minister Wekine Gebeyehu, Ugandan Foreign Minister Sam Kutesha, Kenyan Foreign Minister Amina Mohammed, and Djibouti Foreign Minister Mahmoud Ali Youssef will consult the leaders of the various warring parties. The foreign ministers of IGAD countries will meet President Kiir, First Vice President Taban Dengai, former detainees and other parties under the National Alliance led by Onyote Adigo in mid-October in the capital, Juba. And IGAD ministers are scheduled to meet SPLM-IO leader Riek Machar later this week. The group will also meet with the Lam Akol, leader of the National Democratic Movement, General Thomas Cirillo of the National Salvation Front, and Joseph Bakashoro of the South Sudan National Movement for Change. They will also meet with the women, youth, and church leaders at a later date. Gideon says some groups such as refugees, IDPs, and those within rebel-controlled areas have not been included in the forum to revive the peace deal.
They have not been included in the timeline for consultation. Some of them have already spoken out in the media that for the process to be free and fair and to be credible as such, the consultation should also be extended to them.
Onyote Adigo, the leader of the South Sudan National Alliance and South Sudan's Minister of Agriculture, welcomes IGAD's initiative.
They are trying to bring everyone on board because I have seen also people who were not part of the agreement, who revolt after the agreement, are already being consulted, which I think is not a bad idea because we need to stop this bloodshed in South Sudan as soon as possible.
Gideon says the process to revive the peace deal should review some of the key components of the agreement, such as Chapter 1 and 2, which address power sharing and security arrangements. Gideon says he hopes the process, which is led by Djibouti, this time will silence the guns across South Sudan.
I urge the member states that are of front line to South Sudan to at least put the interests of the people of South Sudan first above their political interests. And therefore, the South Sudanese political leadership will have no choice but to implement the peace agreement. The reason why implementation of the agreement have been dragging feet time and again is that some parties in South Sudan took the support of some of this membership of the frontline state. And that is very sad.
The U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Nikki Haley, told the U.N. Security Council last month that the IGAD Forum is the last chance for South Sudanese leaders to bring peace to their country. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Presidential spokesman Atenuek Atent says President Kiir denies local media reports, saying Mr. Kiir is lobbying for next year's elections to be expedited. Media reports say the president has been consulting with other political leaders on the provisions of the transitional constitution to speed up next year's scheduled elections despite the ongoing conflict. Atent told VOA's Peter Clody the elections would be held in accordance with the 2015 peace agreement.
This is not true because the president did not lobby anybody in regards to the election. But the elections is the requirement of the peace agreement on a solution of conflict in the Republic of South Sudan, which categorically said the election has to be held 3 months before the end of transitional period. So in any event, if the government has to and make sure that, you know, it is the government of the day, then there has to be election in accordance with the agreement or with the provision of the agreement of constitution of resolution of conflict in the Republic of South Sudan.
Attorney, the president's official term expires in February 2018, correct?
Yeah, the transitional period will come to an end in August 2018. That, you know, the government of transitional period will come to an end in accordance with the agreement. And so there has to be elections in, 3 months' time, by that book of the agreement.
The situation in the country currently is not conducive for any possible election, well, by August 2018, is it?
No, no. South Sudan situation is better, you know, compared to other countries that has held elections. We know number of countries that went for elections, when in actual fact, they are not controlling more than 60% of the country. South Sudan, you know, government controls more than 90% of the land in South Sudan, with the exception of a few places whereby pockets of the rebellions are actually operating. So South Sudan is not as destabilized as people may think. So it has what it takes to go for elections. If it is about the insecurity compared to other countries before.
Atei, let me ask you this. The government recently have been saying that, officials of the government have been saying that the government really doesn't have a lot of money. Do you see the government having the funds to support or to give the Electoral Commission to organize the election?
Well, not having money for now is not a big problem, simply because we have resources available to make us have money. So whoever says that has no money is lying. We have the absence of cash for some time, you know, because the oil is being sold at lower rates in the international market, and also the production is small. Plus that we have not embarked on non-oil revenues that may enhance the economy of the country.
That was Atenuek Aten, spokesman for President Kiir. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Clody from Juba. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. South Sudanese refugee children in Uganda have a tough time getting an education. Find out why when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how much influence do your parents have on your decisions?
My parents had an influence on me before they passed away, especially my late dad. He inspired me to be the first in everything. At that time, I was in primary school.
In a case when I need to take any decision, I first consult my parent in order to give me a way out on how I should make a good decision. So they always contribute a lot in everything that I'm doing in my life.
I think they have a large influence on the decisions that I make. Because, well, I have to ask for permission for stuff to do, like if I want to go out, you know, stuff like that.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Kenyan police used tear gas and fired shots in the air today to disperse protesters demanding a change of leadership at the country's election commission. The protest took place in Nairobi and the opposition stronghold of Kisumu in western Kenya, as well as in the coastal city of Mombasa. VOA East Africa correspondent Jill Craig tells VOA's Kim Lewis the protests were called by opposition leader Raila Odinga, who faces President Uhuru Kenyatta in a rerun of the presidential vote scheduled for October 26th.
Raila Odinga, who's the opposition leader here in Kenya, and he's also a presidential candidate, as most people are aware of by this point, he has called for protests, regular protests, until his demands are met by the Electoral Commission. So in Kisumu today, there were protests which involved lots and lots of roadblocks throughout town. It basically meant that traffic was either non-existent in some places or at a standstill in other places. Youth were carrying signs that said Chiloba must go, and Mr. Ezra Chiloba is CEO of the Electoral Commission. The first target by Mr. Odinga in terms of people that he wants to leave the Electoral Commission. Mr. Odinga has said that he, Mr. Chiloba, has colluded with the Jubilee ruling party and therefore he should resign or be fired. The people today were demanding the resignation or firing of Ezra Chiloba. They were very upset and many of them were saying that whatever Odinga decides to do in terms of a boycott, which is the threat, boycott of the election, they will boycott if Odinga tells them to, or they will go to the polls on October 26th, that's planned, all based on what Mr. Odinga says.
So is the expectation that these protests and this unrest will continue?
Well, right now we know there are protests today and there are protests scheduled for Friday. Originally we were told they would be weekly, so right now they're semi-sporadic, but it seems like on average they are planned for about once a week. And as many people remember, last year in 2016, during the summer, there were weekly protests to urge the Electoral Commission to be replaced. That did happen. In January, the Electoral Commission was replaced. So these protests do have a history of working. The only difference is that this time around, we are getting fewer and fewer days until that election rolls around on October 26th. So what many people are questioning is whether or not there's going to be time, even if all of Odinga's demands were met, such as the most important one that he says, the Electoral Commission members, commissioners being fired. I mean, if that were to happen, does that leave us enough time to have proper, credible elections by that October 26th deadline? So I think that's kind of the big question that everyone's asking themselves right now.
That's VOA East Africa correspondent Jill Craig speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis from Kisumu, Kenya. This week is bittersweet for many of us here at VOA. Joe DiCapua, one of the longest-serving managing editors in the English to Africa service, has retired after 26 years of service. DiCapua says he loves the resilience of the African people who have been through terrible events. Shortly before he left, my colleague John Tanza sat down with DiCapua to learn more about how he covered Africa during his 48-year journalism career.
I started when I was a teenager, and I was what was called a copy boy back in New York City at WINS AM, an all-news radio station, and I knew absolutely nothing about radio, just taking it as a job, and I came in knowing nothing. And I learned from some of the best people in the business. I probably learned more there than I did at college, but don't tell my parents because they paid the tuition.
Now, tell us a little bit about your experience here at the Voice of America. I remember you telling me that you came as an intern, and after your internship, they took you over.
Actually, no, I didn't. I actually came as what was called a POV, contractor, which POV stood for Purchase Order Vendor, which makes it sound like you're on the street selling, you know, food to people.
Newspaper and
right,
stuff
anything.
Like that.
But it was a contractor.
And which year was that?
That was 1990. And then I got hired 2 years later. So I was very, very fortunate and very fortunate to be in the African division. I knew nothing about Africa, but I was surrounded by people who took the time to teach me. And I just found it fascinating, and I grew to love the African audience because they take you into their homes. You have to earn their trust, and I think once you do, they're very loyal, and they listen, and they're just wonderful people. And just, I would meet, for example, in the early days, I decided that I wanted to cover HIV/AIDS. And at the time, there was really no treatment for it. But I met so many people who were HIV positive, who were so brave and everything else. It was just amazing, really affected me that these people were so brave. Mm-hmm. And there are so many people. I mean, there was, of course, so many countries in Africa, and trying to learn about them, you know, you can never learn everything. But it's just amazing. I just find the people in some of these countries amazing, what they've been through and what they've accomplished. So it was my education.
Yes, and from 1993, you covered Africa extensively until today. What were some of your exciting moments or sad moments in the newsroom when you were covering Africa?
It's we were here. For example, Shaka Sali and I were here during the Rwandan genocide. A number of our colleagues who were here are no longer with us, unfortunately, at VOA. They've passed. But that was just a horrible situation. And, of course, we didn't have the technology back then, like just having cell phones available where you could go. So it took longer for people in the field to give us that. And that was just a horrible situation. HIV/AIDS, when you just saw so many people dying of the disease, and they knew they were going to die, and yet they were brave enough to care for others who were sicker than they were, and they would try to keep them alive with love and nutrition. That's all they had, love and nutrition, mm-hmm. to keep people alive. And you see this, and it just affects you. Like, you really have to do your best for them when you cover a story, mm-hmm. and not just take things for granted. And now we see, I mean, in your country, South Sudan, what's going on there? And then we hear about what's happening in Yemen and Northeast Nigeria. And it's like, we can't just remain silent. We have to tell the world what's going on.
Yes.
So there'll hopefully be a response.
That's VOA's Joe DiCapua speaking with my colleague John Tanza. Tomorrow, DiCapua has some pointers for South Sudanese journalists covering the nearly four-year-long conflict in South Sudan.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
The trial of a Liberian warlord opens today in the U.S. city of Philadelphia. Mohamed Jabate, notoriously known as Jungle Jabba, a rebel commander during Liberia's 14-year civil war, is accused of committing rapes, murders, acts of ritual cannibalism, and enslavement. He fled Liberia in the mid-1990s and has been living in Philadelphia as a businessman and a father of five. U.S. officials say Jabate lied about his past on forms he filed to obtain political asylum and later permanent residency. Wilmot Cooney is president of the Union of Liberian Associations in the Americas. He tells VOA's James Buddy the union supports the trials of all individuals associated with the atrocities of Liberia's civil war as the only way to bring about reconciliation.
The trials of individuals that are associated with the atrocities in our country for the last 14 years of the Civil War is something that the union applauds. We endorse that. We believe that all those who played a significant role during that period to be held accountable for their actions as a way of actually reconciling the country. So we support the action of the United States government and other governments around the world that are pursuing these individuals and bringing them to the point of accountability, because we think that is the only way that we can reconcile the past and move the country forward. Nevertheless, we don't want to prejudge anybody. We believe that all those that are accused are presumed innocent until proven guilty.
You said that a trial such as the one
that is taking place today, Monday, in Philadelphia. It's important to as a way of reconciliation. But there are those who say in Liberia that it's time to move forward, not to look back at what happened in the past.
That is the paradoxical thing about the Liberian experience. Liberia or Liberians are the few group of people that I know that feel that reconciliation can be done outside the rule of law. We totally reject that premise. We cannot force people to love one another, but we can make people live within the confines of the law. So any reconciliation that rejects accountability, any reconciliation that promotes impunity, James, what do you have with just be short-term peace? Because if individuals are not held accountable for their action, there is the tendency that they can repeat what they did before. So we believe that in order for our society to be reconciled, we have to all conform to the rule of law, as you see here in the United States.
Is it true, Mr. Kony, that some people are planning on demonstrating today, Monday, during the trial?
We heard that from newspaper publications, but there is no evidence of that here that I have seen, or there is no information that I have heard that point to that kind of activity. But at the same time, I will not be surprised if such a demonstration were to occur because, you know, James, we are a funny kind of people. We tend to do things along friendship lines, along ethnic lines, to the extent that when things are bad, once it is done by someone from our ethnicity, there is still some form of support. That is another strange character of our Liberian experience. That at some point or certain situations, we are unable to disassociate ourselves from the activities of our kinsmen, of our family men, of our friends, and of our relatives.
If you say you believe in the rule of law, there are people who have been calling for the establishment of a war crimes tribunal in Liberia in relation to the war.
I think that would be a terrific idea, where the forum would be created for national accountability. The situation in our country, James, is very shameful. Shameful in the sense that you find individuals in our country, key actors. I'm not just talking about ordinary soldiers. I'm talking about key actors, key participants in the slaughter and the massacre of our people parading the corridors of power in Liberia. And the idea is being promoted that to hold those people accountable is to return the country to war. We reject that.
Mr. Kony, it's so nice to talk with you, and thank you very much for joining us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you, James.
That's Wilmot Kony, president of the Union of Liberian Associations in the Americas. He was speaking to VOA's James Buddy from Philadelphia. And that's our show for this Monday. We leave you with the song Yala Kita Wutu by Victoria Ole. We've been listening to Victoria Ole with the song Yala Kita Wutu. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for being here. We'd like to know what you think about our show. You can contact us on the web at southsudan@voanews.com, or you can see us on our Facebook site at South Sudan in Focus. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.